Hello, this is Pastor Patrick Hines here at Federal Heights Presbyterian Church, and I'm going to do another Cobalt Supplemental today. And it's something I've been wanting to do for a while, and I keep emailing it to myself, and then I forget about it or I delete it off of my email. I wanted to do a special program today on my favorite unbeliever, my favorite opponent of Christianity, and that would be Bertrand Russell. Bertrand Russell, actually, fascinating individual, brilliant philosopher, mathematician, and his book, Why I Am Not a Christian, was the first book I ever bought when I was about 21 years old, I think, way back then. This is in the late 1990s. I was introduced to the idea of buying books on the internet, and I thought, can you really do that? And I thought, and put my credit card number into one of these websites and buy something. And I don't even remember what the website was, but I was just shocked that this book actually came. And I read Why I'm Not a Christian by Bertrand Russell. In fact, my paperback is up there over on my atheism shelf. I have a whole bookshelf of books by atheists because I like atheists. I like reading atheists, and not the modern ones. I do not like reading Dennett, Dawkins, Hitchens, Sam Harris. I like reading back when atheists were real atheists. Now, real quick, just some housekeeping things out of the way here. You're wondering what happened here. I did not get into a fight. I was packing down the camper. We have a camper in the backyard, and a lot of times I just open it up because the kids like to play in it. And my wife was like, you got to close that thing down. So went out there and cleaned it off and got the kids out there with me. We took a bunch of wet wipes and wiped down surfaces and got it all cleaned up to kind of close it. And the cords that hold the door, that you attach the door to the ceiling on the inside, is actually the way you do it. I attached it to the ceiling. I thought I had fixed the cord. One of the cords looked like it was broken. And it held it just long enough for me to turn around and do something. And then I turned back around to the door and it broke off. And the full weight of that door hit me right in the head, right there, right on the side of my eye. And I was very, very thankful that it didn't hit me in the eyeball, because that could have been really bad. But it definitely, as soon as it hit me, I knew I was going to have a black eye probably for at least a couple weeks after that. But that was Saturday, so I got to preach on Sunday with a nice black eye that's kind of swollen. And actually, it doesn't really feel that bad anymore, but it looked pretty bad on Sunday. So anyway, that's what happened to my face. Remember, I always point out to people, the way I do these videos with this camera is relatively close to my mug here. You always get to see that week's injuries. Part of the difficulties of having a lot of kids is you play and you get kind of banged up sometimes, and that's okay. But anyway, so I wanted to do some reading from my favorite non-believer, Bertrand Russell. And I say that he's my favorite because he is one of the very few consistent atheists. So one of the other ones that I really, really, really like, and I've got a book of his selected writings that's fascinating to read, is Nietzsche, Friedrich Nietzsche. And Nietzsche, you know, was very controversial during his lifetime, and some of his books, as I understand it, some of his books were even censored because they were seen as dangerous. You know, his book Beyond Good and Evil. You know, the guy basically, he took his atheism like a man, you know. He didn't pretend to believe in things like morality or anything like that. I mean, so many atheists today, if you ask them, well, is rape wrong, is lying wrong? Yes, absolutely, they're totally wrong, and blah, 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 on objective moral principle. These guys didn't do that. The atheists of yesteryear made no pretensions at believing that morality was anything other than a social construct or a chemical, biological, evolutionary leftover from our development that was somehow socially advantageous or something. These guys, you know, Russell, Nietzsche, and there's others. I've got a book over there, The Philosophy of Humanism by Corliss Lamont, and there's another one. What is it? I can't read it from here. It's a green hardback. Fell from church. Let me borrow it. But I like atheists. I've always liked reading them, especially the atheists of yesteryear, who were nothing like their modern counterparts, like Richard Dawkins and that whole, what was it, the Four Horsemen? Was it Dennett, Dawkins, Hitchens, and Sam Harris? I think that was like the four dudes. And there's other guys like Peter Adkins, that chemistry professor at Oxford or something like that. And there's a bunch of them out there. Lawrence Krauss is a theoretical physicist, I think, who likes to pretend that he knows something about theology once in a while. But these guys were great. I really like Russell. This book here, The Problems in Philosophy, I highly recommend it to Christian and non-Christian, theist and anti-theist alike. You should read this, because this guy really takes it like a man. And I've not seen that in his modern counterparts at all, especially with someone like Richard Dawkins. I don't think Dawkins would even understand what Russell was talking about here. Because Dawkins' background is in specialized natural science. He doesn't know anything about philosophy or theology. And, you know, individuals like Michael Ruse and others have pointed out that when Dawkins tries to address things like theology and philosophy, that he is embarrassing because he is incompetent in those fields and has no idea what he's talking about. He doesn't know anything about the Bible, doesn't know anything about the history of Christian thought, doesn't know anything about philosophy or anything of the kind. But Russell was a trained philosopher. That was what he did. He was a philosopher and he was a mathematician. Those were his areas of expertise. And reading this book years ago was so surprising to me, the things he said in here. I've used these quotations for years as an example of an atheist who took his atheism. Of course, he didn't actually wear the title atheist. He said he was an agnostic. But really, functionally speaking, he was an atheist. He really functioned as though there was no God. But in the chapter of this book on, okay, knowledge by acquaintance and knowledge by description, and then there's another one on induction, on inductive reasoning. In fact, let me make sure I got the page numbers right here. He addresses the problems of philosophy. This guy, he really was trying his best. Yeah, I'm sorry, this whole section is in this section on induction. And we'll talk about what that means here in just a minute. Bertrand Russell, like, as I understand it, from the stuff I know about his biography and the stuff I've read by him, what he really was hoping to do in his philosophical undertakings was to try to overcome the real hardcore skepticism of David Hume. And Hume is the guy who helped Immanuel Kant wake up from his quote-unquote dogmatic slumbers. What David Hume, just if you're not familiar with the history of philosophy and like don't know a whole lot about like Kant or Hume or whatever, Hume pushes a radically empirical, that is entirely based on sensation, approach to knowledge, that all knowledge comes through the senses. Really tried to push that to its real hardcore logical conclusions, and it led him to the most radical form of skepticism possible, where Hume really was left saying that, look, we don't even know if causality is a real thing, because all we have is sensation. We sense that the billiard ball struck that billiard ball and caused it to go that direction, but causality is not open to sense perception, and therefore we have no way of knowing if causality is a real thing. Now, no one can actually live their life like that way. And that's one thing, that's one of the things about unbelieving philosophy that makes it really rather useless, is they're really good at coming up with ways of looking at the world that no one can actually function with. And yet, they're trying to be consistent because they were extremely smart. David Hume is one of the most intelligent human beings I've ever tried to read. I mean, he's very difficult to read. He's one of the Scottish empiricists, you know, real high-powered, highfalutin philosophy type. But brilliant genius of a man. And he pushed that empirical approach to knowledge to its logical conclusion, and it landed him in total skepticism. We don't even know if the external world is there. One of his most famous quotations, I remember reading this, he said, and I believe this is a direct quote, "There can, of course, be no proof of a connection between sense perceptions and real objects." You hear what he's saying? All you have are sensations. You don't know if there's anything really there causing it. You don't know if there's actually an object out there causing those sense perceptions. And the way he said it was, we are nothing more than a loose bundling of perceptions. But even that, how did he know that those perceptions were quote-unquote bundled in that way or whatever. So he landed in total skepticism. And there's another kind of funny quotation from him. He said, look, I would rather just play backgammon with my friends than try to figure out whether or not their minds exist or they're really there or something like that. Now, when David Hume crossed the street, I'm sure if he saw a train coming, he did not stand there, well, there can be no proof of a connection between sensations and objects. I'm sure he would get out of the way first and then contemplate whether there was really a train there. Okay, once again, the radical forms of skepticism, they're consistent with their unbelieving presuppositions, but no one can actually live their lives that way. And that's one of the problems I have with all forms of unbelieving philosophy. But I wanted to read just a few quotations on induction. What is induction? Well, induction is the very foundation of doing science. Science cannot yield actual knowledge at all. Science can yield statistical probabilities, and you form hypotheses based on things that are repeatable, and then you, if it repeats itself enough, then you can have a theory, and then eventually it can be elevated to the status of a law. Like, we believe that there is the, quote-unquote, the law of gravity. But what Russell's going to point out here is that actually we don't know that there's a law of gravity. And as a matter of fact, there is no rational foundation in an agnostic or atheistic view of the world to believe that inductive reasoning is valid at all, and there's also no rational foundation to believe it will be valid in the future. Now listen to the way that this exceptional, keen mind, this brilliant, brilliant man describes this. Listen to this. He says, but in spite of the misleadingness of such expectations, they nevertheless exist. The mere fact that something has happened a certain number of times causes animals and men to expect it will happen again. Now, he's right. I mean, even little kids. I mean, the first time a two-year-old ever sees a candle that might be kind of fascinated, ooh, that kind of glows, I'm like, ooh, what's that? And they'll go over, and if there's not an adult around or something, they might, like, try to touch it. And what happens? They get burnt. Now, that child is not going to go walk away from that experience going, wow, that particular instance of flame burned my finger. No. They're going to generalize. They're going to make an inductive judgment that fire in general should not be touched. So Russell's acknowledging, yeah, the fact that something happened a bunch of times in the past makes men and animals expect it will happen again. Thus, our instincts certainly cause us to believe that the sun will rise tomorrow, but we may be in no better a position than the chicken, which unexpectedly has its neck wrung. We have therefore to distinguish the fact that past uniformities cause expectations as to the future from the question whether there is any reasonable ground for giving weight to such expectations after the question of their validity has been raised. See what this brilliant guy is saying here? It's like, look, just because it causes certain instincts to kind of kick in, that does not mean that we can proceed or that we have any reason to proceed on the expectation that those uniformities, that those things that have happened a certain way in the past will continue to do so in the future. He's right. In an atheist, agnostic view of the world, you have no reason, no rational reason whatsoever to believe that the future will resemble the past at all in terms of its law-like qualities. And yet, every single person listening to me right now proceeds, not expecting those uniformities to stay consistent, and for the laws of chemistry and physics and everything else, and matter and everything else to remain consistent, we know it will. We all proceed knowing that. But Russell, being a very, very exceptional, keen mind, he wants to know why. Is there a reason? Is there a rational foundation for that? You see, Russell, at the outset of his life, he really did think that through the application of logical analysis that he could overcome the skepticism of David Hume. And towards the end of his life, he admitted that he had not been able to do so. And that he, in fact, there's a famous quotation where Russell says, most of what passes for knowledge is open to reasonable doubt. And he wanted to know, are there things that we can really know for sure? In fact, he even says, and I believe it's in his book, Portraits of Memory, Portraits from Memory, or My Philosophies, one of those two, where he says he wanted to know if we could know anything for sure in the same way that religious people want faith. He wanted to know if knowledge was even possible. But I wonder if he thought he knew that, he wanted to know that. Anyway, so listen to the next paragraph. The problem we have to discuss is whether there is any reason for believing in what is called the uniformity of nature. Now, David Hume talks about the uniformity of nature, too. What is the uniformity of nature? Well, it's basically the idea that nature is basically uniform in terms of its law-like characteristics. Like, out there in the parking lot, I'm pretty sure gravity is uniform. Gravity works over there, too, even though I'm not over there. I mean, is there a chance that I might step out of the church and fall upwards and, like, fly into outer space? Do we have a reason to believe in the uniformity of nature? Now, Russell is going to say, no. As a matter of fact, we can't base our future expectations on the past because that's begging the question and is logically fallacious. Listen to what this guy says here. The belief in the uniformity of nature is the belief that everything that has happened or will happen is an instance of some general law to which there are no exceptions. The crude expectations, which we have been considering, are all subject to exceptions and therefore liable to disappoint those who entertain them. But science habitually assumes, at least as a working hypothesis, that general rules which have exceptions can be replaced by general rules which have no exceptions. Unsupported bodies in the air fall is a general rule to which balloons and airplanes are exceptions. But the laws of motion and the law of gravitation, which account for the fact that most bodies fall, also accounts for the fact that balloons and airplanes can rise. Thus, the laws of motion and the law of gravitation are not subject to these exceptions. The belief that the sun will rise tomorrow might be falsified if the earth suddenly came into contact with a large body which destroyed its rotation, but the laws of motion and the law of gravitation would not be infringed by such an event. The business of science is to find uniformities, such as the laws of motion and the law of gravitation, to which, so far as our experience extends, there are no exceptions. He's right. You hear what he's saying? Science cannot be done without laws. There's no point in even doing it at all. If we don't believe that the law-like characteristics of the universe are going to continue to be law-like in the future, we have no reason to do science. And so that's what he's saying. Science looks for laws like that. I mean, you can't do science without them, right? I mean, wouldn't it be weird if, like Peter Atkins, that atheist chemistry professor, if all of a sudden chemicals did not, and the elements of the world did not interact according to the same laws that they've always interacted with? I mean, doesn't he think that the chemical formulas will balance out in the same ways? Like, the problems that are given to chemistry students, they're still solved using the same laws a year from now or 5 years from now? Or do chemistry textbooks have to be updated all the time because all of a sudden chemicals don't interact with each other the way they always have? No, we look for those laws. Now listen to what Russell says. In this search, science has been remarkably successful, and it may be conceded that such uniformities have held hitherto. This brings us back to the question. See how smart this guy is? Listen, have we any reason, assuming that they have always held in the past, to suppose that they will hold in the future? You hear what he's asking? He's saying, well, just because it's always been like that in the past, we have no reason. It is not rational to proceed thinking that those laws are going to still be law-like 5 minutes from now, or 5 seconds from now, or 5 microseconds from now. And yet everyone listening to me right now, every person, no matter what you believe, atheist, agnostic, Satanist, or Christian, everyone proceeds believing that they will. Listen to this next paragraph. I wrote years ago when I read this incredible admission. Listen to what he says next. It has been argued that we have reason to know that the future will resemble the past because what was the future has constantly become the past and has always been found to resemble the past, so that we really have experience of the future, namely of times which were formerly future, which we may call past futures. But such an argument really begs the very question at issue. Do you understand what it means to beg the question? Begging the question means assuming what you're supposed to prove. What Russell is saying here, if you ever think or say, well, of course we do science because, and we proceed on the expectation that the laws will stay law-like because they've always done that in the past. If you turn that argument into Russell, if he was your teacher, he would give you an F in the class. Because what you just said is completely false. It is a logical fallacy of begging the question. You just assumed what you're supposed to be proving. And because things have always been law-like in the past, it does not follow logically that they will be that way in the future. Not even statistically. Not even probably. Well, yes, it does. Listen to this keen, this exceptional mind. Listen to him again. Such an argument begs the question. You're begging the question. We have experience of past futures, but not of future futures. And the question is, will future futures resemble past futures? This question is not to be answered by an argument which starts from past futures alone. So, you cannot argue logically. It is totally wrong to argue. Well, I mean, chemistry and physics and calculus and mathematics have always worked in the past. Stands to reason they'll work in the future. Russell's whole point is, no, it doesn't stand to reason that they'll work in the future. There's no reason at all. Listen to what he's saying. What he's saying is he has no reason to do science. There is no rational reason to do science if you're an atheist or an agnostic. You have no reason to do science, to believe that it will work in the future. None. And if you try to say, well, it's always worked in the past, Russell's saying you're begging the question. It's logically fallacious, and therefore that argument is false. Listen to what he says next. We have therefore still to seek for some principle which shall enable us to know that the future will follow the same laws as the past. We have therefore still to seek for some principle which shall enable us to know that the future will follow the same laws as the past. You hear what he just said? I don't know. Do we have any reason to believe the future will resemble the past in terms of its law-like characteristics that govern the universe in terms of gravity, mathematics, chemistry, physics? Russell says, beats me. But will it? Well, it's always been like that in the past. No, that's begging the question. You're avoiding the issue. Russell says, well, we got to keep looking for some principle because we don't know of one. And since then, no one has come up with one either, at least from his perspective. Okay, and that's pretty remarkable. I mean, pretty amazing. And I remember reading through the rest of this. I wrote a bunch of other stuff in the margin here. He says, thus our inductive principle is at any rate not capable of being disproved by an appeal to experience. The inductive principle, however, is equally incapable of being proved by an appeal to experience. He's right. He says, hence we can never use experience to prove the inductive principle without begging the question. So, if you're going to say, if you're a physicist, a chemist, a paleontologist, an evolutionary biologist, well, you know, the laws of chemistry will line up these molecules in a certain way. Maybe it's possible they could form a DNA strand or something like that. Russell's point is, you still haven't answered the key question. Why should we proceed on the expectation that the future will resemble the past in terms of its law-like qualities? You cannot answer that question by an appeal to the past. It's begging the question, completely logically fallacious, and therefore false. You see, I miss people like this. I miss atheists like this. I miss agnostics that were this sharp. Okay? He took it like a man. Here you have a guy saying that we have no reason to do science. Because we have no foundation, we have no reason to think the future is going to resemble the past in terms of its law-like qualities. If we have no reason to do that, then we have no reason to do science. And yet, Russell just kept right on doing science. And people keep right on doing science. Now, I'm a Christian. I have a reason to believe the future will resemble the past. It's called the providence of God. his most holy, wise, and powerful, preserving and governing all his creatures and all their actions. Scripture says that God created man with inborn curiosity because he wanted man to take dominion over and to subdue the creation. To study it, to figure it out. That's why human beings, we can't help ourselves. We want to understand stuff. We want to figure stuff out. We want to solve problems. If God did not preserve the universe in a law-like fashion, we wouldn't be able to do that. We wouldn't be able to take dominion over it. And so the preservation and the law-like governing of creation is done by God so that man can take dominion over, study, and subdue the created order. But if you reject divine revelation, if you reject God, you're left with this. Induction, doing science, is nothing but a big problem for which we have no answer. And that's why, where are the Bertrand Russells of today? Dawkins, honestly, does he have an answer for this? Except to just spit at someone and insult them and tell them they're stupid and not educated enough or something? I mean, these modern guys, they've never even thought about things like this. That's what bothers me about them. And people eat it up. I mean, Richard Dawkins throws a piece of raw meat to his followers and they all stand up and cheer for 15 minutes. What I want to know is, where are these guys? Where are the Nietzsches who make no pretensions about moral absolutes? I mean, not even using the, well, our society this says this is wrong. He didn't even see that as legitimate or valid because he was a lion. He was a lion of an atheist. So was this guy. So was Russell. Russell was someone I admire. You know, people whose minds are like that. Even though I disagree with him, obviously, because I'm a Christian. He was an opponent of Christianity. I like reading him because he was just brilliant. I have learned a lot about how to think clearly from reading Bertrand Russell. I really have. And, I have a bunch of other stuff highlighted here. I'm looking at this is my old copy of this. I wrote all kinds of stuff in this book years ago. He is so interesting to me to read because he took his atheism and his agnosticism like a man and says, look, if you want to base the foundation of doing science on an appeal to the past, well, you're just begging the question and you don't understand the issue. And he said, you can't do that. That is question begging. Question begging is a logical fallacy. And any argument that begs the question is, by definition, false. So if you say, we do science because it's always worked in the past, that is not a rational foundation for doing science because you're begging the question. Russell says, we have still to seek for some principle. Now, I know what the principle is. God created the world. God upholds it, preserves it, holds it together in a law-like fashion, so that man is able to subdue it, study it, and take dominion over it. I have a rational foundation. I have an answer to that question. But if you're going to say, no, we can't invoke God, we can't invoke anything beyond nature, yada, 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 well then, let the skeptic and the atheist and the agnostic, let them stand up and answer these questions. Let them give answers to the real problems of philosophy. Now, how about people stop just throwing mud and insults and actually get down to the basic questions and try to provide answers for them? Have the atheists or the agnostics come up with an answer for what Russell identifies as the problem? Never heard of it. Never heard of one. And in fact, I'm not aware of any that are even trying to answer questions like that. None of the new atheists, I think, honestly, sincerely, would even understand what he was saying. So, okay, that's back when atheists took their atheism and their agnosticism like men. Do we have a reason to do science? Russell says, no. But we'll just keep doing it anyway. Do we have a rational foundation to believe the future will resemble the past? No. We have still to seek for some principle. Well, it's always worked like that in the past. You can't say that. I think Russell would laugh at people that argued like that. He would just say, you're begging the question. You're not answering the question. You're dancing a jig around the question. Why should we proceed believing that nature will be uniform and law-like? I have an answer. God governs the world. God created it. He upholds it. By his providence, he preserves and governs it in a law-like fashion. If he didn't, we wouldn't even be able to communicate with each other. If we couldn't proceed knowing the future will resemble the past in its law-like qualities, we wouldn't even be able to talk to each other, let alone do science. That's why it was the Reformation after the 16th century that gave rise to science, and most of the early scientists were Christian theists because of their doctrine of creation and providence. They understood the world is law-like, we can study it, we can take dominion over it, and we can figure it out. We can cure diseases, we can make inventions, we can expect nature to be uniform, and so on and so forth. So, we're at the 30-minute mark. Thank you for watching or for listening. This is Pastor Patrick Hines of Bridal Heights Presbyterian Church, and you've been listening to the Pulpit Supplemental Podcast. You can find us on the web at www.bridwellheightspca.org. Our sermons are streamed through Sermon Audio, and you can listen to that on the iTunes podcast version of Bridal Heights Presbyterian Church. Feel free to join us any Sunday morning for worship at 11 a.m. sharp at 108 Bridwell Heights Road in Kingsport, Tennessee. And may the Lord bless you and keep you. The Lord make his face to shine upon you and be gracious unto you. The Lord lift up his countenance upon you and give you peace.